you mention it, it was a very good, my very best friend was arrested once, and it reminded me, the story reminding me of that, and it's actually a very good story, but I don't think I can tell it now because it's just too much fun. But the upshot of it was that my best friend was in jail in the Fremantle lockup for 3 days. Actually, he was in the lockup because of something he'd done on his birthday. But anyway, he was in the lockup, and I wanted to comfort him, and I gave him two books to comfort him in his days in the lockup. One of them was Hofstadter's Gödel, Escher, Bach, and the other one was the I Ching. And the cops nicked the I Ching, and that reminded me.
Isn't that amazing? Huh? So there you go.
So we're talking about, thank you very much to both of your presentations, and I must admit I felt a lot of connection, especially with both of you saying that there's a sort of question about this kind of immediacy of kind of experience, and that this is based on something which is not kind of mediated or defined by some kind of concept or institution or something like that. Of course, in Buddhism we call this Dhamma, yeah? And the word you mentioned, Artha, of course, is also used in Buddhism, not so well known, but actually in the Buddhist scriptures, the word Artha or Artha in Pali is also used more or less as a synonym for Dhamma in the same sense. So it's interesting for me to hear that that's used in that way. So, I want to talk a little bit about mythology and story and the role of women in that. Buddhism, and of course, many of you know that one of the things that I've been doing is trying to, I don't know the exact verb to use here, revitalize or help to re-establish the order of Buddhist nuns. I mean, I've got this Buddhist nuns called bhikkhunis, and in the kind of Buddhism that I was ordained in, Theravada Buddhism, then they don't exist anymore. They sort of died out, however that may have happened. So this is the kind of story that you had a balanced structure. You had monastic and lay communities of male and female, and it was a balanced kind of nice structure. And that's gone. Yeah, it's been broken. And the story that has actually encapsulated very, very beautifully, I read this article by this German philologist, Oskar von Huber, who's a classical, old-style Herr Professor, and he was writing this very kind of analytical, philological, linguistic kind of article with lots of footnotes and blah, blah, blah. And at one point he was discussing the various readings in one particular passage referring to bhikkhunis, and he was discussing the reading found in a particular ancient Sanskrit manuscript, which is like dug up out of the desert somewhere in Afghanistan and brought, and he said, well, and he's discussing whether the bhikkhunis are mentioned in some particular passage or not. And he said that in this particular manuscript, the word bhikkhuni doesn't occur, but there's a hole in the manuscript the size of the word bhikkhuni. And so we can infer that they must have been there. Yeah? And I don't think he got it, but isn't that beautiful? So this encapsulates the role of bhikkhunis in certainly Theravada Buddhism, is that there's a bhikkhuni-sized hole in Buddhism. Okay, and we can guess that they belong there somehow, but they kind of disappear. So of course there's many different aspects to this particular problem that we want to do, and I think that it's obvious to anyone with half a brain that we can't even think about trying to establish a relevant or meaningful spirituality in this day and age without giving women an equal go. Okay? And I think that's ridiculous to even try to bother thinking about it. You're just wasting your time. So we have to do this. Now within Buddhism, we do this within a particular framework. We have a particular structure. We do have scriptures. We have a canon. And that's regarded with great reverence within a Buddhist context. We also have a monastic institution which has sort of been passed down through the ages. And that monastic institution is in many ways very beautiful and has preserved many, many beautiful values. But it's also become, in some respects, quite corrupted and quite decadent. So it's very ambiguous. It's not black and white. We've got a very complex heritage. And so we're kind of dealing with this. Now, when we're thinking about bhikkhunis and the role of bhikkhunis, one aspect of it, and what I've noticed in Buddhism, is that modern Buddhism, which is basically any kind of Buddhism which you or I are likely to have encountered, okay, modern Buddhism presents itself as being rational. Yeah? And you've no doubt read many, many books, introduction to Buddhism books, and they say Buddhism is a rational religion and it's all based on evidence and so on and so forth and so forth. Now that's all fine and good, but in a sense it's also avoiding looking at the fact that there are obviously irrational things going on in Buddhism as well. Discrimination against women is not a rational thing, and yet it's obviously there. So we have to say, well, what's actually happening? And what I've found is that when we're discussing bhikkhunis and bhikkhuni issues is that the conversation tends to focus on or be diverted to questions, kind of rational questions like ordination lineages and the way that we interpret particular aspects of our disciplinary code and things like that. So we're kind of considering these kinds of things as if it's a rational question. Okay? And we're avoiding the fact that it's not a rational question at all. It's a simple, the point of view that does not want to give a fair go to women is an irrational thing, and it's coming from some kind of unexamined or ununderstood or whatever place within ourselves. And so we have to try to look at that. Now, one of the things that I found is interesting is looking at how that becomes expressed through Buddhist mythology, and especially the way that the feminine images are presented in Buddhist mythology. And often what I've found is that the kind of the unconscious elements of Buddhism are kind of tucked away in the myths and the stories, because they can't be expressed in the conscious doctrine. And so this is the kind of some of the research that I've been doing in the last little while. Now, in Buddhism, of course, a large amount of Buddhism is actually the story of the life of the Buddha, right? And if you encounter Buddhism in any kind of popular context, that's usually your entry point, okay? Many times when you go to a monastery, they've got the pictures up on the walls, all the different episodes in the life of the Buddha, and you can go through and you learn all of those things. Okay, so we learn Buddhism, or in popular Buddhism, Buddhist culture, learn Buddhism primarily through the life story of the Buddha, and that life story is not just this life. Jatakas always tell the past life story of the Buddha and various characters. The Buddha is associated with the various characters, like Ananda, his favourite disciple, or Sariputta and Moggallana, the chief disciples, and so on and so forth. So they appear in these Jataka stories, which are stories of the past. And what it seems to me is emerging from this is that somehow that in these Jataka stories, where maybe the Buddhist community has projected its own unconscious associations with certain people in the life of the Buddha through who they've chosen to identify in the past life. Yeah? So this is the kind of interesting dynamic that's going on. But I'll give you some examples of this. Now, if you look at who are the women in the life of the Buddha, okay, the Buddha's ladies, right? First one was his mum. Who was she? Who was the Buddha's mother? We have a name. The name Maya. Maya means?
Illusion.
No, it means illusion.
Magic.
Yeah, it means magic. Yeah? Maya means magic. It means something that you see, that you think you see, but it's not really there. Yeah? That's the name of the Buddha's mother. Now, quite possibly that was just a name, right? It doesn't mean anything. Right? But on the other hand, it's a bit curious, isn't it? Yeah? Now we ask, what do we know about Maya? We know that of course she gave birth to the Buddha. We can know pretty much that she died early. We're talking about the reality of death, yeah? Now, could this be that the Buddha's mother was his first teacher? Yeah? And that was where that strand came from. This kind of subconscious impression before he could even know or think about it rationally, before he'd even really been able to cognize his mother as a separate being, and suddenly he's just coming to that, and then suddenly she's gone forever. Yeah? And so she, in a way, is an illusion to him. Yeah? Because she was never made conscious to him. She disappeared before he was able to realize that. But she's also an illusion to us because we don't know anything else about her, really. Of course, there's many details in later legends and so on. It's the kind of legends you were saying, you know, she's got six arms and three heads and all of these kinds of things. But the actual ones where we know something about her personally, there's almost nothing. We know her name, and we know that she died soon after the Buddha died. But even that is not a personal detail, actually. And there's this very interesting sutta where it talks about all the things that happened when the Buddha was born and conceived and so on, and all these miracles that are supposed to happen. Light appears in the universe and all of these kinds of things happen. But each one is said to be what they call dhammata, which means, in Pali, means it's the nature of things, okay? What that means is that this is like a transpersonal truth. It's a law of nature. It's not a personal fact about Maya at all. It's the same thing for every Buddha and every Buddha era. So even these details are not actual details about Maya. They're details about what the word that uses in the text is not Maya. It actually uses Bodhisattva Mata, the mother of the Bodhisattva. Yeah? And so if we ask, what do we know personally about Maya? The answer is almost nothing, actually. Okay, fair enough, she was born in the Sakyan Republic. Fair enough, we know her family details and backgrounds. These come from much later texts, but they're probably reliable. So yeah, we can infer some personal details like that. But we have this idea of the Buddha's mother and the Buddha's mother is very idealized. All of these, the birth thing, like, you know, there's no pain involved, there's no blood, there's no mess, there's no mucus, anything like that. He just kind of emerges out, and then these jets of water appear from the sky and they bathe him, even though he's clean already. Devas receive him, and this is very important. The devas come and take him first before he stands in the ground. Yeah, so he doesn't stand in the ground first, he's received by deities first. He stands above the ground. So all of these kinds of things, and we have Mahamaya, her full name is called Mahamaya Devi, Devi meaning princess or queen, but also meaning goddess. The great goddess of illusion has given birth to the Buddha. And another little interesting detail, which I kind of found almost by accident, is it says that Maya was going on a journey because in those days, and apparently it's still a custom in parts of India today, that the mother would go back to the maternal home to give birth. And while on the journey, in between, neither in the father's home nor the mother's home, yeah, in the journey, that's when she decided to go into the park at Lumbini to play. And that's what it says, right? She went into the park to play. And I found this both in the Pali scriptures and also in the Sanskrit scriptures, Sarvasivadana. It says that she wanted to go into the park to play. And it's when she went into the park to play, that's when she gave birth to the Buddha. So neither in the mother nor in the father's home, in the wilderness, in the park, the play of magic. And this is where the Buddha was born. Quite interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And then she disappears. Like a magic show, yeah? She vanishes. Yeah? So the Buddha is brought up by his second mother. Yeah? So he has two mothers. Maya is one, and Mahapajapati is the other. So this is Maya's sister, yeah? Who is the foster mother. She suckled the baby, fed him with her own breast milk, and brought him up. So she did the dirty work, right? She was the one changing the nappies, yeah? She was the one who was there every day, getting up in the night time to hold him and rock him as he was crying and so on, yeah? And so she's like the earthly or the worldly mother, and while Maya is the spiritual or the heavenly mother. And this motif, if you're familiar with mythology, is one of the classic motifs of mythology, is that the parents are split into two. You have the divine mother and father, and the worldly mother and father. And almost every myth of every great hero or whatever, then you find this motif worked in there somehow. And so you have this split. And so she is the one who's involved in the world, and she's the stepmother, right? Now, when have you ever heard of a stepmother who wasn't wicked? Right? So she's the one who everything bad can be projected on her. Yeah? Everything good has been projected on Maya, because she's conveniently out of the way. So you can get this very idealized impression of the Buddha's mother, who's actually just a figment of our imagination. Yeah? And then that leaves the negative stuff to be dumped on top of Mahavajapati. So, later on, the Buddha, of course, just skipped over big chunks of everything, and then he went forth, he became a monk, he got enlightened. There you go, enlightened, that's great. Later on, he goes back home, okay? Now, when he goes back home, the relations with his family are very interesting and quite complex, and I can't go into all of the things here, but it's just to notice that it was actually the Buddha's relatives who caused most of the problems in Buddhism. Yeah, we all know about Devadatta, was like the Judas of the Buddha's story, yeah, the Buddha's cousin, and various others who were less evil but still misbehaved in one way or another. Now, at this time we have the story, as it has been passed down, of the founding of the Bhikkhuni order. And that story, of course, is the story where Mahavajapati, the Buddha's foster mother, comes to ask for ordination. Okay? Now, this story is found very widely. It's repeated across all the different schools of Buddhism, all the traditions of Buddhism. It's found in the earlier strata of texts, although not in the earliest strata of all, but certainly I would date the story to within 100 or 200 years after the Buddha passed away, so certainly quite an early story. And in this particular story, Mahavajapati goes to the Buddha, says, "Oh, I want to go forth as a bhikkhuni and practice the Dhamma." Now, what would you imagine that a fully enlightened Buddha would do? Of course, would say, "Great, come on, practice the Dhamma." Okay. Whenever the monks, any men went to him to ask for ordination, he would use the phrase, especially in those early years, he would use the phrase, "Ehi bhikkhu," okay, come bhikkhu, live the holy life for the complete ending of suffering. Yeah? But with Mahavajapati, he says, "Don't say that. Don't ask for ordination for women." Right? Three times she asks, three times he says no. Then she leaves. Okay? Now, it's a bit problematic, isn't it? Then later on, he goes away. She and the rest of the ladies, who were like the kind of the upper class ladies, you know, they were driving their kind of, I don't know, SUVs or something like that, or something like that. Anyway, they were from Pilara or something, and they all shaved their head and put robes on, and then went following up again, walking on the journey, with sore feet, okay? Fake monks, right? They hadn't got a proper ordination or anything. They were pretend monks, just like she was a pretend mum. Yeah? So she wasn't the real mum, but she kind of was, but then she wasn't the real mum, but she kind of was. So she's kind of following after. She gets to the monastery where the Buddha's staying in. And they stand outside the gates, weeping. Yeah? Outside of the gates, weeping. And so again, you know, you can just notice the kind of the projections on Mahavajapati. She's a fake monk. She's crying. Right? Which no self-respecting monk would ever do. Right? And so she's got all these kind of womanly weaknesses. So then Ananda comes along, right? Now, Ananda, of course, the Buddha's relatives also, and he's very kind of soft-hearted, and he comes along. He sees his auntie there. He says, "Oh, what's going on? What's the problem?" And then she tells him the story. He says, "Okay, I'll take the message to the Buddha." He goes and says, "Lord, it would be good if you were to give ordination to Mahapajapati." And he says, "Don't ask that again three times." Okay. Finally, Ananda says, "But Lord," and it's interesting that here there's two. Well, there's really three things that are said here. And the sequence in which they're said, the emphasis with which they are, and so on, is in different ways in different traditions. Okay, so we can't. The story is told again and again and again, which is quite interesting. One of them, it says that the Buddha owed Mahapajapati a great favour because she brought him up, she fed him on her own breast milk, and so on and so forth. Therefore, he should have the gratitude. Second reason, Ananda said that. Or ask whether they have bhikkhunis in all the dispensations, all the Buddhas. Okay, so according to Buddhist cosmology, there are many, many Buddhas in the past and in the future. And so, did they have bhikkhuni ordination as well? And he said, yes, they do. Okay, in most versions, in one version, he said, no, they don't. Right, so take your pick. But most of the time, he said, yes, they do. And the third thing is. If they ordain, can they get enlightened? Right? And the Buddha said, yes, they are capable of full enlightenment. Okay? So there's a very interesting ambiguity in the whole thing. On the one hand, there's an absolute clear, crystal clear cut spiritual statement that says that women are capable of exactly the same spiritual goal as men, and there's no difference whatsoever. And that's black and white, and right there in the earliest texts found across all the different traditions. And it's not at all contested. And on the other hand, there's this thing of saying, no, you can't ordain. And so then he's like, well, what's going on here? And the Buddha doesn't say anything at that stage. Or maybe he does, or maybe he doesn't, because we hear the story from many different voices, told by many different times by many different people, none of whom were bhikkhunis. Right? We heard the story told by different groups of bhikkhus. Now, then he says, okay, I'll give her 8 rules. Okay? And then that can be her ordination. So the 8 rules, first rule, I won't go into all of them, the first rule says that a bhikkhuni who's ordained for 100 years must bow down to a monk even ordained on that very day. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Now, I don't know why, but some women have a problem with this. and stuff. But as far as I'm aware, the monks don't have a problem. Should be all right. Now, anyway, and there's a bunch of other rules which we don't have the time to go into. So it's just interesting to notice is that the first reaction is we've got to control the women with a set of rules, right? Rules, we're going to contain them, we're going to put them here, and we're going to make sure that there's a hierarchy and we know who's on top, right? Now, what these rules you carried on is don't do, and this is also very important to acknowledge, is that they do not create any kind of explicit power relationship. Okay? There's obviously an implicit power relationship in there, but there's no power of command, okay, anywhere in Buddhist scripture. So no monk can have the power to order a nun to do anything. Okay? There's no power of command of that kind whatsoever. But obviously there is a hierarchy established there. So Ananda goes off, and the Buddha says, if Mahapajapati will accept this, then that's her ordination. So Ananda goes off, tells Mahapajapati. She says, just like a young boy or girl who's youthful and beautiful and fond of their appearance would take a garland of flowers and place it above their head, like a crown, in the same way I would take these 8 garudamas and place them above my head and preserve them for the whole rest of my life without transgression. Okay? If that can, I can be ordained. So then Ananda says, that's good. He goes and tells the Buddha, and the Buddha says, if Mahapajapati hadn't taken ordination, then Buddhism would have lasted for 1,000 years. But now Buddhism will only last for 500 years. Right? There's a mathematical problem here. Even 2,500 years later, but anyway. And he said, the most interesting thing to me is that like a disease called red rot would destroy the sugar cane. Yeah? And red rot is actually still a disease. It's still around today in Sri Lanka and India. And if you, you cut the sugar cane open, and it's stained like blood inside the sugar cane. And just like the disease called sedapika, is white bones would destroy a field of wheat. Yeah? So this is what the Buddha is comparing. Well, I think the text is, I don't know what the Buddha was saying, I don't know if the Buddha had anything to do with this, but the text is comparing the ordination of nuns to a disease which is destroying the crops. It's a bit much in it, yeah? And then it says just like a flood, yeah? It compares it like a flood. So I've laid down these rules, it's like a dam to hold back the flood, yeah? So it's very, again, very interesting, yeah? It's very kind of disturbing imagery, yeah? To think of somebody who the Buddha just said, he just said, yes, they can become arahants, they can get fully enlightened, no problems, right? But they're a disease. They're a flood. Anyway, so the Buddha goes back, so Ananda goes back and tells Mahapajapati, okay, that's fine, it's accepted your ordination. Is that Garudamas, which you just said you're going to carry like a wreath of flowers above your head? And she says, that's fine. Okay, I'm ordained. And she says, but just one thing. He says, yeah, what? And she says, that rule about having the nuns having to bow down to monks, do you reckon you could change that one? She just said that, oh, I'll carry these the whole of my life like a girl in the flowers. She said, oh, you know, they're allowed to change their minds too, so this is a kind of thing. And the Buddha gave an interesting response to that, and he said that even other badly taught religions don't allow women to don't allow equality between monks and nuns or between men and women, right? So even badly explained religions don't allow equality. So how can I allow it? Which again seems a very curious piece of logic to me. Well, badly explained religions didn't allow it, that are well anyway. That's what the text says. So who am I to question that? Well, once or twice when I question that. So we have this myth, which is, I think, profoundly disturbing, and I think that we need to kind of make that conscious and to appreciate the fact that it is quite a disturbing set of images. And, you know, it would be interesting just in the future just to notice this. Actually, I was just reading a retelling of that story today in one of, you know, in a modern book, a sort of popular book on Buddhist nuns, and it's interesting that they didn't mention those bits about nuns being a disease and all the things. It's right over the top. And I've noticed this quite a few times, is that bit has now been shunted into the unconscious, okay? We don't want to know that, because that's too hard to face up to and to really try to appreciate, yeah? And so, again, what's going on here, probably a lot of things, many which are it takes a lot of exploring and a lot of consideration to figure out what's going on. But just to suggest that one of the things that's being, of course, just to suggest this, as a possibility or an opening for interpretation, is this idea that I mentioned before, like the splitting of the two mothers, yeah? So you have the spiritual mother and the worldly mother. So that's allowing the negative qualities which are associated or have been constructed around women to be projected upon Mahapajapati, okay? So she's got like a dirty body, yeah? She's kind of leaking fluids, yeah? Almost every time that her name is mentioned, she's either crying or it's talking about her breastfeeding the Buddha or something like that. So she's constantly associated with these kinds of things. And so these kind of negative projections on women are associated with Mahapajapati, and somehow that is going to be destructive to the Sangha as a whole. So the Sangha is the monastic community. Now, to try to see how that may be, one of the monastic community, or the Buddhist monastic community, in a sense is a community which is but which is managed by a set of rules we call the Vinaya Code. Now, the very existence of a rule tells you that there's the opposite of it. Okay, so you don't make rules for something which is everyone does it anyway, right? You make rules for things that people are going to break. So whenever you make a rule, that tells you that somebody was actually breaking it, right? So, and this is something we often misunderstand when we read ancient scriptures. We think it's because if this is what it's saying, then that must have been what's happening. Actually, if that's what it was saying, then the opposite must also have been happening. Yeah? Otherwise, the rule wouldn't have been laid down. So, for example, this thing about the paying of respects by men to men, so the women having to pay respects to the monks, and. You know, it sounds like it's establishing this kind of very unilateral, one-way power relationship. So what you have is a group of men who are trying to set up a men's club, right? They're trying to set up the, whatever, Freemasonry, or the army, or the government, or the judiciary, all of which started out as men's clubs, yeah? All of these things are boys' clubs. So most of the actual institutions we have in our society started out that way. The actual formal institutions. This is what blokes do. Yeah, they create structures based around sets of rules and procedures. And there's always a fear that that's good, because once you've set those boundaries, there's a fear that that's going to be dissolved back into the kind of the ocean. Yeah, and so this is obviously quite explicitly that fear which is being addressed there. The fear that that ocean is going to dissolve and make the sangha disappear. In those days, you know, let's think 100 years after the Buddha, 200 years after the Buddha, we have a very different perspective. 2,500 years after the Buddha, we know that everything went tickety-boo, right? More or less. I mean, we have a few problems with that, but we're still here, and we're still doing okay, right? So, but they didn't know that, yeah? And they were just one of the dozens of different religious movements happening in India at that time, and they felt that they had something really precious. They felt that they had a really precious message and teaching which could be of incredible value to many people, and that needed to be preserved. Yeah? And so my feeling is that they got a bit neurotic about it, yeah? And got kind of obsessed with trying to preserve the form of those things and trying to prevent any kind of leaking in or out of that. And so this is why the rules are constructed and try to control that. Of course, there's many other things going on here. But just to say that what I think in summary is that Mahavajapati was acting as a projection for woman as the embodiment of the world. Okay? And in myth and so on, woman is often projected in this way. She is the earth, yeah? She is the womb of life and death and all of these kinds of things. And this was this is like the world, in a sense, is coming in. So rather than seeing Mahavajapati and Vikunis as being human beings who are suffering and who want to try to use the Dhamma to escape from that suffering, they're being projected on as the leaking in of the world into the Sangha, and this is where the danger came from. But of course, that's only part of the story, that's like the official story, but if we look, then we think, obviously things must have been much more complex than that. And so I'll just give a couple of examples of how things must have been more complex than that. One of the Garudhammas I didn't mention, it says that monks are allowed to admonish nuns or criticize nuns, but nuns aren't allowed to criticize monks. Right? Now, can you imagine that that's ever been the case? Can you imagine ever living with a bunch of nuns who are not going to tell the monks off? I mean, whoever wrote that rule has precisely zero understanding of human nature. And, of course, what's interesting about it is that I've looked through as much as I can of all the Buddhist literature. I can't find a single case where that rule's been applied. Right? But I can find plenty of cases where nuns have been giving the monks a right old ticking off, and nothing seems to be considered. There's no problem with it. Okay, I'll just give a couple of examples of that. One story comes from the time of King Ashoka. And, oh no, both of these stories come around the time of King Ashoka, about 250 BC. And there was, first story. They were going to have a big ceremony. Okay, the king was sponsoring this royal ceremony. They were going to invite 1,000 monks to come to this ceremony. And this bhikshuni, this nun at the time, was reflected to herself, who's going to be the senior most monk at this assembly? Yeah? And she reflected, and she knew this very old monk was going to be the senior monk there. And then she thought, oh, because this nun was enlightened. Okay, so she thought, well, is this monk going to be enlightened? And she found out, no, he's not. Okay, he's been practicing for so many years, but he's never got anywhere. All the other monks are going to be enlightened. He's going to be number one, and he's got nothing. Right? So she said, it's a bit of a problem. So she went to see the monk, and she said, Venerable Sir, you are not in strict propriety. And he said, what do you mean by that? I didn't shave today. Right, okay, I better go. And so he went off and he shaved and made himself a mask and came back. And then she comes back again. She says, Venerable Sir, you are not in strict propriety. She says, I've shaved. Honestly, my robe hasn't been washed for a few days. Maybe I better go and wash my robes and stuff. Maybe I'm starting to smell or something. So he goes off and washes his robes, comes back. She comes again. She says, Venerable Sir, you are not in strict propriety. He says, what are you talking about? Yeah, I've had a shave, I've washed my robes, what have you got to complain about now? These nuns always whinging about these things. She says, Venerable Sir, it's not merely by shaving one's face and by washing one's robes that one is held to be in strict propriety in the Buddhist religion. And then when she said that, he realized what she meant, and he broke down in tears and wept and said, Sister, all this time I've been practicing, I'm too old now. Yeah, I'm too old, I can't realise anything, I'm past it. And then she gave this very beautiful Dhamma verse, which says that time is meaningless, and time there's no such thing as the right time, and that wherever we are right now is the right time to practice, so there's no age in Buddhist practice. So then she taught this verse, and then she recommended he go and practice with a monk called Upagupta, who was the great meditation master at the time. And so he did practice with Upagupta, became an arahant, and then came back, and then headed the assembly as a fully enlightened arahant. Mm-hmm. And then the nun comes to him and says, Venerable Sir, today you are indeed in strict propriety.
Do you shave him
at that? So this is a very lovely story, isn't it? And there's another story also featuring the monk Upagupta, who had one regret, and that was he was born too late, and he'd never seen the Buddha. And so this... He really wanted to see the Buddha. And he heard that there was one very, very old bhikkhuni, one nun, who was still alive, who'd been alive in the day of the Buddha. Okay? And she was the only person left in the whole world who was still had known the Buddha personally. So he went to see her. And when she heard that he was going to come and see her, she got a bowl and filled it to the brim with sesame oil. Right up to the brim. And then placed it just by the doorway. Okay? Now, just to kind of back up, but this imagery of the bowl filled with sesame oil is always used as an imagery for something like mindfulness of the body. Yeah? So it's like that kind of idea, the kind of immanent idea where your consciousness is immersed in the body and you can like hold your awareness as carefully as holding a bowl of oil without letting it drop. And so this is what she put this next to the doorway as a test. So Upagupta comes, tries to open the door very mindfully, but can't help himself. Knocks the bowl and spills the oil. Okay? She didn't say anything. Right? And he comes in and he says, "Oh, sister, I hear that you know, I want to hear stories from the time of the Buddha. You were there. What happened? How did you meet the Buddha?" And she said, "Oh, it was in the year that the Buddha passed away. And I was a little girl. I was only 7 years old at that time. So the Buddha came for alms to my house, my parents' house. And when I saw the Buddha coming for alms, I bowed down to him. I was filled with such joy, even as a seven-year-old girl. I bowed down to him to pay respect. But I had a little brooch in my hair. And when I bowed down to him, the brooch fell out of my hair. The hair clip fell out and fell underneath a chair. Yeah? And I was crying because I lost my hair clip and no one could find it. And then the Buddha used his psychic powers and said, oh, little girl, your little hair clip is just under the thing. So he showed me where my hair clip was. And after that, then she was filled with so much joy and appreciation. Later, she went and became a nun. And so Upagupta said, oh, Sahib, what a beautiful story. And he said, now please tell me, what were the monks like in those days, in the time of the Buddha? And she said, well, the monks in those days were so lovely, so well practiced, and so mindful, you know. There was even in those days, there's a famous group of bad boys in Buddhism, right? So the Buddhist monks are called the group of six monks, okay? Now, They are really bad, okay? Everything bad they did, right? There's only one group of people who are worse than the group of six monks, right? And that's the group of six monks. Although in some traditions they have the group of 12 monks, although it's only twice as bad. But anyway, she says that, you know, in those Buddha days that the monks were so well practiced that even the group of six monks didn't spill my oil when they came. So this is, that's how she gave Gaurabhutta Gupta a telling off. And he was so filled with sadness, thinking, oh, I've lived in such degenerate times. I'm so bad, I'm such a bad monk. I'm not even as good as the group of six monks. So this, again, this is showing, this is, these stories are really lovely because they show how the kind of the relations between the monks and nuns was much more subtle. You know, you get these kind of rules kind of say things, but actually what's going on is much more playful and much more interesting. There's one more little story that I'll tell here, which is actually also quite a little funky story. For this story, there's a particular monk who was living in a cave in the Himalayas, and, you know, doing the whole wishy thing, sitting there meditate, not yet enlightened. Some thieves had captured some gold, right? And they were carrying with this gold, running and trying to escape from the king's soldiers and things, and trying to get away. They couldn't carry the gold any further, it was too heavy. So they abandoned it in this cave where the monk was. They didn't see the monk sitting in the back meditating. And they just said, oh, we'll just have to drop this and get out of here, otherwise it's going to be gone. So they went off. So this gold was there in this cave, and this monk was sitting there. And of course he couldn't stop thinking about it, yeah? Thinking about it. And then eventually he sort of took the gold and then put it away and hid it and kept it for himself. Now the Buddha knew that this had happened, of course, using his psychic powers. And so he wanted to teach that monk. So he chose a rather unusual teaching method, which is not paralleled as far as I know anywhere else in Buddhist scriptures. Now this is not necessarily a historically verifiable story. But he changed his form into a woman, became a bhikkhuni, and put makeup on and jewellery. Okay? So you've now got this tarted up bhikkhuni who's really the Buddha. Uh-huh. I'm just a storyteller, I don't know. He walks along and this monk sees her and says, "Sister, what are you doing? You're a nun, you're not supposed to be wearing makeup and jewellery." And she says, "Look who's talking, mate. You're telling me off, and you've got a big pile of gold in your cave over there." So of course, he was so filled with remorse and so on that he didn't get away from it. Right, so it's a bit kinky, isn't it? When he gave it, I'm not sure what he did with the gold.
What the right thing to do?
Well, I think the right thing was to stop hoarding it for himself. maybe he gave it back to the king or something like that. So this is, again, they're just a few stories from Buddhism about the role of women and so on.
Yeah.